with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Hauck.
Okay, well, good afternoon, everybody, wherever you are in this world at this time. Welcome to the last day of April. Here we are. Oh my gosh, where is the month? Where is the year, let alone the month going? Where is the year going? And, hopefully your April was nice for you. It was nice and pleasant where I live. We've had some pretty interesting storms, interesting weather, but it unfortunately felt like July out here. We're not quite ready for that, nonetheless, hopefully it'll settle down and we'll get back into more like spring-like weather instead of thrusting us right away into summer. But at any rate, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, finding your courage to reclaim that which has always been in you. Very excited to be with you here today and every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, straight up noon Pacific Standard Time, and every time in between. So each and every week, these broadcasts, for those of you who are new to the program, these broadcasts focus on the integration of spirituality and our mental health. And it's all within the context of our relationships with ourselves, with others, and God or the divine. And the reason why I place this integration right in the context of relationships is because we are social creatures, okay? We are relational beings. We do not come into this world without being in relationship, and we do not leave this world without being in relationship, okay? Because whenever we think about it, we often receive our deepest physical, emotional, psychological, even spiritual wounds in and through very hurtful relationships. However, we can discover our greatest healing and strength and peace and forgiveness and love through healthier relationships. Okay, and these relationships don't have to be, we don't have to search far and wide for them because they could be right within our own families or our coworkers or our friends. Because the interesting thing is that whenever we find transformation, we also transform others by our presence and our grace and our understanding. But first, forgiveness, kindness, compassion begins with how we treat ourselves, because whenever we are compassionate with ourselves, we can then be compassionate with others. And whenever we are more forgiving of ourselves, we can then be more forgiving with others. And when we are able to live in gratitude with ourselves, we then discover how this opens our hearts to see and live in gratitude with others. However, the same could be said if we flip it around, that when we are compassionate with others, what is keeping us from being compassionate with ourselves? Or let's say if we are able to forgive others, what then is keeping us from forgiving ourselves? And when we appreciate how somebody else lives in gratitude and is very generous with their time or whatever resources they have, that also opens up our hearts to be able to live in gratitude with ourselves and to really understand what's keeping us from bringing that out. What's keeping us from living in gratitude? Is it unforgiveness? Is it bitterness? Is it the need to be right versus being in right relationships? Whatever it is, you know, these things just kind of shine a little spotlight right into our core, and they just show us where the work that we need to do. So all in all, transformation, first and foremost, begins with us. I'm a big fan, those of you who have been listening to this show, I'm a big fan of Carl Rogers, and he is a psychiatrist, or was a psychiatrist, and the founder of person-centered therapy. And he once said, one of my favorite quotes from him is, he once said, when the other person is hurting or confused or troubled or anxious or alienated or terrified, or when he or she is doubtful of their self-worth, or they may be uncertain as to their identity, then understanding is called for from us. And the gentle and sensitive companionship of an empathic stance, sorry there, got tongue-tied, provides illumination and healing. In such situations, deep understanding is the most precious gift we can give to one another. So how do we do this? Well, this is exactly what this show is all about, helping you to discover and rediscover and reclaim that which has always been in you. Well, as I said, good afternoon. I am Dr. James Houck, and if you want more information about me or to leave me your comments about today's show, I invite you to visit the website. It's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And in just in case you cannot stay the whole hour with me, these broadcasts are also podcasted. In case you want to go back and listen again, or you can go back into the archives, through accessing the website and listen to previous shows. And if you would like to call in and be a part of today's show, I invite you to call the toll-free line, 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008, and share with me your insights and your comments and your thoughts on today's subject, the exquisite witness, living in sacred neutral. Well, as I said at the beginning of this show, for those of you who are new to the program, I am a firm believer that all of us come into the world already equipped and graced with everything that we need in this life in terms of our giftedness, our talents, our strengths, our character traits, and so forth. Yet, as we go along in life, and maybe due to some unpleasant experiences, we may feel like we need to hide that giftedness, what's special about us, and so forth, because we feel like, well, there was really nothing to that, or I may not even know my uniqueness or my giftedness yet. Or we may push that giftedness and those skills way down so that others cannot see it, because perhaps those things that we once enjoyed doing were the subject of ridicule, or some subject of speculation, or in some way it was downplayed or minimized, or it wasn't appreciated, or whatever it was that turned into a wound for us. Or maybe we were even told that we would never amount to anything, or whatever other voice we heard telling us that there's really nothing special to us. And that's just a flat-out lie. That comes from just a very wounded place in somebody else, in others. And as I was sharing with somebody earlier today, that when people say hurtful things to us, it's just, those are just words. But they bounce off of us and kind of fall to the ground like hitting Teflon, we're okay. But as soon as we, take in those messages, we integrate those negative messages, and we start to believe those negative messages, that's where toxicity begins to take root in us. And when there's toxic things in us, it has a tendency to turn into bitterness, unforgiveness, anger, rage, whatever it is. But it all comes from that place in us, that toxicity of these messages that just minimize who we are truly. But in reclaiming our authenticity and our genuineness, we have the ability then to reclaim, and we stand firm and we walk in a kind of a newness of life. And we can approach our relationships through a place of healing or wholeness, and we can embrace our hachetas, our uniqueness. Okay. Well, last week, and this is kind of a part two from last week, but last week I talked about the phenomena called emotional intelligence. which was brought to the public's attention in a very popular way by Daniel Goleman and others, which ironically, when placed in the context of careers or the workplace, it really focuses more on what society would call the soft skills. Okay. And they include interpersonal skills or how we treat one another, basic decency, understanding, openness, and teachability, and so forth. Okay. And over the years, it has been interesting to see how Goleman's emotional intelligence has made its way into the workforce. Okay. And nowadays, employers seem to be interested in hiring people with, yes, of course, the technical skills, like if you have certain skills in computer training or running a certain machine or whatever that might be for the job that you are applying to. Yeah, they're definitely interested in hiring people with the technical skills, but they also want people who possess emotional intelligence as well, or these soft skills. And I remember I was counseling an older gentleman, and he was, at one point in his life, he was in charge of pretty much hiring and firing people for the company. He worked in HR. And, we got on the subject of the work that he does and why he loves to do it. And this emotional intelligence came up. And he said to me, look, I can teach anybody a hard skill. I can teach anybody how to run a machine. I can teach them how to run a computer program or whatever it is. But I can't teach them soft skills or these non-technical skills that relate to how they work. You know, and they include, you know, how we interact with our colleagues or how you solve problems or even how you manage your time at work. And he said all these things have to be cultivated within. So the effects of emotional intelligence have been measured in various ways within the workforce, very, very positive ways. And these ways include, you know, just providing like increased team performance, you know, say projects or whatever is needed for the company, or improved decision making, because you may not necessarily want to make a decision just based on cold numbers, but take into consideration the human factor and how your products or your services affect people and the skills that are needed for that. Or it's also seen as increased leadership ability, you know, one who is not so much like a top down, but one who wants feedback from his or her employees. They want people with ideas and good critical thinking skills or creative skills and so forth. And it also increases personal well-being, where people feel like they're a part of a team or that their voice matters. And as you know, this goes without saying, but then when you have these things, you're certainly going to reduce any kind of staff turnover. It's just, and that's got to be one of the frustrating things in many companies. It's just, you know, we have people coming in and going out, coming in, going out. And that takes a lot of time and resources and money to train new people. Okay. As well as decreased occupational stress. I mean, these are all benefits of just having emotional intelligence, okay? But emotional intelligence is not just limited to, say, the workplace or within careers, okay? And the direction I want to go today is that although as popular as emotional intelligence is, there's a greater dimension to how we often understand or react to our emotions, okay? And that is, how comfortable are we to sit with our emotions and resist the temptation to not only label them, but also to resist avoiding feeling guilty about our emotions? In other words, can we allow ourselves to be an exquisite witness in living in sacred neutral? Well, the first time I ever heard this phrase, exquisite witness, was when I met Dr. Shep Jeffries at a summer graduate course on loss and grief at Loyola University in Columbia, Maryland, which is just outside Baltimore. And I'll never forget it. It was a warm, you know, kind of like mid-June day. And I was the first one there because I was coming from out of state and driving down to Columbia. And I got there and Shep was already there and he was getting the room arranged and getting his files together and so forth. And I remember walking in there and I saw that the chairs were placed in a semicircle. And boxes of tissues were placed every third chair. And Shep, very polite, very, very polite, very approachable, very just a nice, nice man. And, he kind of looks like Lou Grant from the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And, because he just wore the, the white short sleeve shirt, kind of like disheveled tie and black pants. White socks and then black shoes. And then of course he had like the big hairy arms, like just looked like Lou Grant. And, I'm just thinking to myself, oh my gosh, what is this guy going to teach me? What's he going to teach us? And, I have to be in this class for the next 4 weeks, three times a week. And it's just going to be awful. It's going to be so academic. And I just, very quietly took my seat and just got myself ready for class to begin. And Shep, he just sat there, at the front. He just sat there quietly with a very calm expression on his face and greeting everybody who came into the room. And the expression on the people's faces, my classmates, were just priceless because the first thing they did was they just said hello to Shep. And then they looked at the tissues and everybody, including myself, scoffed at these tissue boxes. Everybody thought, oh, yeah, right. I don't need those things. You ain't going to make me cry. All right. Well, little did we know that, we are grateful for those tissues because once we were all there he called attendance and all that stuff and that was fine. He took the first hour of class and he shared his own stories of loss and pain and anger and grief and frustration and healing. And before the hour was up, we were all diving for those tissues. And the only lessons I remember extensively about that 4-week course were two things. Shep taught me about change equals loss equals grief, which means any kind of change in our lives, whether it be the death of a loved one or good changes, is going to kick up a sense of loss in our lives of what we once knew. And wherever there is loss in our life, it has to be grieved. Okay. And the second thing I learned from him was his teaching on being an exquisite witness. Okay. And Shep always defined being an exquisite witness this way. He says, the exquisite witness is a healthcare pastoral or volunteer care provider who enters the sacred space between two human souls and yet having the deepest respect for the yearning, seeking, wishful hopes of the other to diminish pain and survive in a new world after a loss. The term exquisite witness encompasses my beliefs regarding the role of anyone who steps forward to help a grieving person, a medical or mental health professional, a teacher, funeral director, fire, police, or rescue personnel, employee assistance counselor, a medical receptionist, or a family member who becomes the home caregiver can certainly assume this role. An exquisite witness might be a friend, someone from a faith community who comes to visit the family, or even a surgeon who stops by the recovery room after removing a tumor and then proceeds to reassure the waiting loved ones. What distinguishes an exquisite witness is not one's level of training, but rather one's willingness to approach another human being with compassion and deep respect for that person's needs, fear, and grief. the exquisite nature of the interaction is measured definitely in terms of respect, care, honesty, and the ability to truly hear and understand the grieving person's anger and confusion. It may take very little time. A gifted psychiatrist whom I accompanied on rounds for medically ill patients at the Johns Hopkins Hospital was able, during a 10-minute conversation, to answer patients' concerns and make them feel cared for, respected, and hopeful. And I have also seen a member of the household staff, of the housekeeping staff, on an inpatient AIDS unit, calm an agitated patient with a smile and a casual conversation about the Baltimore Orioles lineup. The term witness directs the care provider to understand that the grief journey belongs to the grieving person, whether he or she has lost a loved one or has chronic terminal illness or has been admitted to the hospital for tests or has a loved one who is ill or dying or has new job responsibilities in a reorganized workplace. But as a witness, we observe more than we act. We listen more than we talk, and we follow more than we lead. Witnessing celebrates the dignity and authority of the grieving person. And what makes his exquisite witness very effective is that Shep placed within all of this, he placed the exquisite witness right in the context of what he called a head, hand, and heart dimension. And he said that an exquisite witness must address personal loss issues or the heart dimension and is knowledgeable about what to expect from grieving people, the head dimension, and one who has the skills to respond both usefully and reassuringly, or the hands dimension. So the head, the heart, and the hands. And I tell you, when I finally understood the depth of what is the exquisite witness, it radically shaped my life. It was something that I had never heard before, but I liked it. I liked it so much that I embraced the head, heart, and hand dimension of how do we live this out? How do we embrace, let's say, even the emotional intelligence in our lives? But, you know, how unfortunate is it that in some societies and even, you know, United States, that there is still much fear around emotions? In fact, there's a lot of confusion out there that emotions are the enemy. Okay, that to be emotional is just wrong. You know, get a grip on yourself. Stop that. Just, you know, get a handle on things. And this, unfortunately, is you know, it's often the case, but it shouldn't be this way. Okay, because we all have our God-given emotions. You know, such things as anger and joy, and sadness and fear and disgust and surprise and anticipation, you know, and happiness, just to name a few. And just as we've come into this world with the best of ourselves in terms of our mental dimensions, in terms of our physical dimensions, in terms of our spiritual dimensions, we also come into this world with the very best of ourselves that include our emotional dimension. And even Daniel Goleman himself, the author of Emotional Intelligence, he states that feeling emotions is what makes life rich. And indeed, our lives are often comprised of many changing emotions. And this is very true. And you know that whenever we are able to understand emotions, we often realize that emotions provide us important information about our needs and the needs of others. But it's important to understand how we handle our emotions, you know, ours and others, that can really uplift, really support, or can truly destroy a relationship. You know, because the intensity of our emotions, that can certainly cause us to say or do things that we will later regret. In fact, whenever our emotions are strong, they can actually prevent us from speaking the truth or sharing things that have deep meaning for us. You know, because oftentimes we just simply do not have the words to express what we are feeling. Well, the author of the book, Say What You Mean, Orrin J. Sofer, he states that emotions are multifaceted and they're typically felt in the body. And if, you know, you understand what he's saying here, you realize that emotions can be quite intense and we can feel them quite intensely, you know, in a physical sense. And just think of it this way, in an eruption of anger or fear or pain, we might have a tendency to lash out at loved ones or somebody else, or we ourselves just might have been on the receiving end of somebody who's experiencing strong emotions but just does not know any other way to express these things. Well, we often believe that emotions are the enemy. You know, they just don't have a place in today's society. They don't have a place in us. And you know, and if you're going to be emotional, then go somewhere else. And we get conditioned, you know, to even thinking that we either want to run from them or hide them, or we've been told not to really trust our emotions. And I usually say that when it comes to, especially in the world of addictions, and why people will use alcohol this way or drugs or some other form of addiction, could be Gambling Anonymous or whatever, that people often want to feel something or they want to feel nothing. You know, it you know, if we want to feel something, it just means that we are just so shut down with our emotions that, you know, whatever the addiction is, it makes us feel like we're coming alive because we can feel something. Or perhaps we feel nothing or we want to feel nothing because, you know, the emotions are just raw. Our pain is just excruciating. You know, the emotional suffering is just unbearable. And we just don't want to feel any of that. Okay? But either way, when we either want to feel something or feel nothing because of things are just being so overwhelmed, it often, you know, it keeps us from labeling our emotions for, you know, being either positive, negative, good, or bad. You know, because think of it this way. We're either pulled into our past because of previous wounds or we fear being wounded again in the future. I mean, either way, these extremes keep us from being fully present with one another. Well, I would really love to hear your heart on this matter. Like I said, we all have emotions. So I invite you to call in and let's talk about this spiritual side of emotional intelligence, walking the sacred path. So if you would like to call in, the number is 888-627-6008, and I will be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Houck. I'll be back with you in 1 minute. Okay, welcome back. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Just want to give you a little heads up about next week's show. It's entitled Walking the Journey of Forgiveness. Walking the Journey of Forgiveness. Yeah, we'll talk about forgiveness. We'll talk about what it means to be forgiving. But what does it mean when we claim this identity of forgiveness? Okay, and what is this new identity that we take on when we embrace our forgiveness? And how do we walk in that? Just like how do we walk in gratitude? Okay, where does that come from? How does that, you know, flow out of us? And what sparks it? What touches it off? So tune in next Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and noon Pacific Standard Time for Walking the Journey of Forgiveness. Well, earlier in the show, I was talking about how often we believe that our emotions are not something to be trusted, that we are told that they are, you know, being downplayed, or there's a weakness to them if we happen to be emotional a certain time or a certain context and so forth. But yet there is this exquisite witness to living in, I would say, a sacred neutralness of our emotions, because we often get pulled in many directions with our emotions. And so, as I also mentioned in the first part of the show, the exquisite witness was a term that I had learned from one of my teachers, Shep Jeffries. And, you know, he was talking about he uses the term, I should say, exquisite witness, that encompasses his beliefs regarding the role of anybody who steps forward to help anyone. Or he put it in the context of helping a grieving person. And then he also broadened it. Then he said, look, a medical or mental health professional, a teacher, funeral director, fire, police, rescue personnel, a medical receptionist or a family member, or let's broaden it even further. How about the next door neighbor? Or how about somebody you've never met before? You know, somebody who becomes this exquisite witness, where, you know, it could be a friend, but you know, somebody who is right there at just the right time and could have been an answer to one of your prayers. Okay, but it's this willingness, as he put it, to approach another human being with compassion and deep respect for that person's needs, fear, and grief. See, it just, in terms of relationships, being an exquisite witness really turns just what society thinks about being there for others, you know, really turns it on its head. Because how often are we in relationships with others and, you know, very quickly it might just enter into our minds, but, you know, if we sit with it more, then, you know, we got to do something about it. But how many times does, you know, we see somebody and we're looking at them and or whatever, and it's quickly this flash is, what can I get from them? You know, what do they have that I can get from them? Okay, and it doesn't have to be anything materialistic. It's just, you know, something that we admire in them. And it's like, oh, okay, I'm attracted to that person. So, you know, because I can get something from them. Instead of, what can I give them? Okay, so, I mean, being an exquisite witness, you know, as this, we approach another human being with compassion and deep, deep, deep respect for that person's needs, fear, and grief, we're coming at them, we're approaching them with this understanding of what can I give them? What do they need in this moment? Okay, not what they needed in the past or what they might need in the future, but what do they need in the moment? Okay, but as I said, let's bring this back into being an exquisite witness with our emotions and just sitting with them because as I shared in the first part, first half of the show, that we often want to run from our emotions, or we want to hide them, or we've been told not to trust our emotions, especially when it comes to, let's say, pretty heavy duty decisions that we need to make. You know, it's like, stop being emotional about it and just think cold and rationally. And that may not always, suit the occasion. And this is something that I often see in just dealing, you know, with people who are in recovery with their, you know, from whatever addictions that they had. That, you know, people who are get caught up in their addictions either wanted to feel something or they wanted to feel nothing. And usually it's they just wanted to feel nothing because, you know, their emotional pain is just, you know, just heavy. Okay. But, think about it. It's the hardest thing for many people is to sit with themselves without judging themselves, to just sit and be in that exquisite witness place and just hold the emotions without labeling them. Without, you know, okay, well, this is good, this is bad, I don't like this, I like this, you know, but just allow the emotions to come up and allow them to speak to us. Because these emotions come from somewhere, you know, the joy comes from somewhere, but also so does the anger, so does the rage, so does the disappointment, so does the fear, and so on and so on and so on. Okay? These things just don't occur in a vacuum. But they often can become our greatest teacher, and they just point to something deeper in ourselves, okay? But as I said, the hardest thing for many people is to sit with themselves and, you know, without judging themselves or without judging their emotions. And, you know, therein lies this foundation with meditation, you know, to just sit relaxed and to focus on our breath and allow ourselves to be that exquisite witness with ourselves or of ourselves, not to judge the emotions or whatever's coming up, the thoughts, whatever's coming up in that moment, but allow them to speak to us and draw our focus to deeper levels of awareness. Because transformation is all around us. It's all around us. It's continuous, kind of like the cycle of death and resurrection. I mean, each year we witness this cycle, you know, it's just evident in the change of seasons, you know, as summer gives way to autumn and which gives way to winter, then which gives way to spring, and then it gives way to summer, which gives way to autumn, and then gives way to winter. It's just a continuous seasonal change. It's a transformation. And there's even a death-resurrection metaphor that underlines the work of psychotherapy. In fact, more often than not, transformation occurs in the most unlikely places when we are not paying attention. Well, years ago, I, in one of the mental health offices where I worked, hung a large framed quote from the family therapist, Virginia Satir. Now, Virginia Satir, she was born in 1916, and she lived during the time where, still the Victorian era was going on, but the world of psychotherapy was still a male-dominated field. And Virginia comes along with her training and her brilliance in just wedding Eastern and Western philosophies together. And she made it work. And so she always started out in family therapy. But, you know, if you ever read one of her books, or if you're ever lucky enough to see one of her videos, I believe she passed in 1980, I'm going to say the late 80s, like around 88, 89. You know, again, just like Carl Rogers, she was the technique. Okay. Everybody wanted to emulate her. Everybody wanted to, you know, just imitate her, but she was just so integrated with, you know, kind of like Eastern Western approach philosophy to mental health. And again, she pulled it all in to relationships. And the quote that hung in that office that I saw day in and day out that just really started to, you know, to nag at me is this: I want to love you without clutching. I want to appreciate you without judging. I want to join you without invading. I want to invite you without demanding. I want to leave you without guilt. And I want to criticize you without blaming and help you without insulting. And if I can have the same from you, then we can truly meet each other. Okay? And day after day, like I said, I passed this quote, but I never really stopped to read it. I mean, let alone understand its impact on relationships, both within and outside counseling relationships. So one day I was eating my lunch and I read and reread and reread that quote slowly. And I remember thinking to myself, well, this is a powerful saying, far too demanding, but it's still a powerful saying. Too many conditions and changes would be required of people to reach this. And moreover, you know, I assumed it's so unrealistic to place this pressure on another person and expect them to keep their part of the bargain. Okay? Because where I was coming from at that time in my life, in counseling and pastoral settings, I've witnessed too many people, including myself, too many people making excuses for not wanting to be authentic in relationships. You know, I've heard things like, I've been hurt, and so you fooled me once, and shame on you, and she hurt my feelings, and so forth, or you don't know what happened to me, and on and on and on. And yet, there was something resonating within me, something that was identifying with those words, almost as if I had the truth staring me right in the face. And so for the days and weeks that followed, this kind of gnawing inside of me to reclaim my own authenticity only became stronger. And I have to admit, Satir's words just pursued me like a shadow. I mean, little did I realize that I was reading her goals for her own life. See, as I said, that she was born in 1916, and Virginia was certainly ahead of her time. But instead of viewing humanity's problems as stemming from the neurosis of her day, as she called it, she believed problems were the result of how people were unprepared to cope with life's challenges, whether it was the past or the present or the future. And she used to say, life is not what it's supposed to be. It's what it is. The way you cope with it makes all the difference. Life is not what it's supposed to be. It is what it is. The way you cope with it makes the difference. Okay? And Satir believed that all people are equipped with the capacity for growth or transformation and continuing, you know, their education and their endeavors and so forth. And she really focused her technique on finding or helping people find their true inner self. Okay. And in fact, it could be said that Satir's life, you know, and her passion in working with people and families especially, was to empower them to live more congruent, genuine lives. And so if you listen to the beginning of this broadcast, when I shared that is exactly where I am, Virginia Satir had a huge impact on my understanding of, you know, what are these gifts that we bring into the world? Gifts that were recognized by the universe, recognized by God, recognized by the divine. You know, as it reminds us in scripture, you know, before you were born, I knew you. And what does that look like? You know, what exactly did God or the universe see in us before we came into this world? And so we have been gifted. We have been graced. We have been given our skills and our talents and our own personalities and so forth. And these are, I'm convinced, again, that allow us to give expression in great diversity to the divine in us. But how often do we allow, like, the wounded parts of society to dictate what they are comfortable in seeing or hearing? I mean, how often do we allow society to just say, well, okay, when it comes to, let's say, your emotions, go somewhere else and do that, okay? But we're not really being true to ourselves if we exclude the emotional aspects of us. But if we can learn how to sit in that sacred neutral and we can learn to be the exquisite witness with ourselves, we allow ourselves to be without making excuses. We allow our authenticity to come forth. We allow our true voice to be heard. And then we find it as the cry of the depth of our soul. Okay, and you've heard me say this many times, this is very contagious, because whenever we act in authentic ways, we're giving people permission to also be authentic as well. And as we're comfortable with our emotions and expressing our emotions, we're actually giving others that permission too, that I can handle your emotions. I am not going to be offended by them. I am not going to be afraid of those emotions, because I understand that they're coming from a much deeper, deeper place in you. Well, authenticity is still a foreign concept to many people, you know, and even though society doesn't know what to call it, I mean, many people are attracted to genuineness and desperately want more of it in their relationships. It's just, how do I do this? Okay, and I sit with couples, I sit with families, and I say, this is what is actually you're telling me. Yes, you want things to be better. Yes, you want to stop arguing. Yes, you want communication skills. Yes, you want trust and all that. I get that. But what they really want is to be in an authentic relationship with one another, where they don't have to hide who they are or how they feel or whatever else they need to guard or protect themselves from. Okay? But, you know, in a sense, they just, not just in families, but everybody, you know, we all ask this question, you know, just how real can I be with somebody else? You know, because it's one thing to look at ourselves in the mirror and we're just like, oh, okay, that's you. All right. But it's also another matter altogether not to succumb to the opinions of others. And that also includes our emotions. You know, like, you know, men should not cry. Men do not need to be emotional. The only emotion that men can express is anger. And as a man, that's a total crock. I have lived under that distorted image for many a years, thinking like, this is how men should be. You know, the only expression we expect out of men is anger. And that's just wrong, because I've had some very wonderful men in my life who were very nurturing, very kind, a strong opinion. Yeah. And okay, at times they also got angry, but yet they had this gentleness. They had this gentle strength about them as well, because they knew who they were and they weren't living based on somebody else's opinion. And the same thing is true for women. You know, it's just not to allow yourself to just fall under the opinion of others just simply because, well, these are the expectations of society, and therefore we need you to act a certain way so that we are comfortable with that. And again, that just, you know, tries to sweep authenticity under the rug. Okay. So, I mean, too often we live our lives under this bombardment, this relentless bombardment of another person's condition for acceptance. And Satire also used to say that we must not allow other person's limited perceptions to define us. And when we think about it, you know, we're raised with so many conditions that are placed on love and relationships or the right kind of performance and perspectives, that we often approach life with, you know, just we're suspect of it. We always are thinking like, okay, what's the catch? Well, in his book, Return of the Prodigal Son, Henry Nouwen, he paints a picture here that just demonstrates just how unfulfilling conditional love is. And he says, at issue here is the question, to whom do I belong? Do I belong to God or do I belong to the world? Many of my daily preoccupations suggest that I belong more to the world than to God, because a little criticism makes me angry, and a little rejection makes me depressed. A little praise raises my spirit, and a little success excites me. It takes very little to raise me up or thrust me down. And often I feel like I'm a small boat on the ocean, completely at the mercy of its waves. And all the time and energy I spend in keeping some kind of balance and preventing myself from being tipped over and drowning shows that my life is mostly a struggle for survival. Not a holy struggle, mind you, but an anxious struggle resulting from the mistaken idea that it is the world that defines me. So, as long as I keep running about asking, do you love me? I mean, do you really love me? I give all the power to the voices of the world and put myself in chains because the world is filled with ifs. The world says, yes, I love you if you are good looking. And yes, I love you if you are intelligent. And I love you if you are wealthy. I love you if you have a good education or a good job or good connections. I love you if you produce much. I love you if you sell much. And I love you if you buy much. However, there are endless ifs hidden in the world's loves. These ifs enslave me, since it's impossible to respond adequately to all of them. Because you see, the world's love is and will always be conditional. And so as long as I keep looking for my true self in the world of conditional love, I will remain hooked to the world, trying and failing, trying and failing and trying again. It is a world that fosters addictions because what it offers cannot satisfy the deepest craving of my heart. Well, certainly in my work as a mental health therapist and a pastoral professional, I assist people to become more authentic in their relationships and to take an honest look at themselves and ourselves and consider what role and what responsibility that we have in relationships. Because too often, you know, people in general, we want to blame others for their own mistakes or problems or sleepless nights and emotion. But, you know, if truth be told, according to the band The Eagles, what's that, the lyrics here? So oftentimes it happens that we live our lives in chains and we never know we have the key. Again, this philosophy sounds great, but it also takes courage to turn the key, let alone step outside the chains and walk in a newfound freedom. This is a very similar metaphor that's found in Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. And yes, I know it's the end of April, but just follow me here, okay? Charles Dickens was deeply disturbed by the way the poor were being treated in his day, and his writings were often viewed in response to the British government, you know, changing the welfare system known back in those days as the Poor Laws, which required children to work in tin mines and factories and welfare applicants to work on treadmills and machine engine powered, you know, turned by walking. And in Dickens' eyes, the Industrial Revolution drove many people into poverty, and yet while at the same time neglecting its obligation to provide humane social services. And this was the whole reason why he wrote A Christmas Carol, was to show just how Ebenezer Scrooge was just weighed down by the chains, but he never realized that he had the key. Well, authenticity allows us the ability to move past this preoccupation of things that are beyond our control, as well as to abandon unnecessary concerns of preconceived notions of others with respect to ourselves. I mean, in short, that is the ultimate form of empowerment and responsibility. So discovering our authentic selves, as well as the daily commitment to live congruently and living in a sacred neutral, being that exquisite witness, we experience firsthand personal freedom and the responsibility that it produces. Well, I'm Dr. James Houck, and you have been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. I am glad that you had spent this hour with me, and invite you to tune in every Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Standard Time. And as I said, if you want to shoot me an email or leave me your comments, visit the website, www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. Well, until we talk again, everybody out there, be safe, be well, and by all means, behave yourselves. All right? Take care, and God bless.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander on over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Friday at noon Pacific Time on PBS Radio TV.